Are you aware that the white pattern on your cat in this photo is the Mothman?
What? What do you mean it's the Mothman?
I'm staring at it right now.
Yeah, I kind of see it. It could be a snow owl. It's a weird observation.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
And with me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles. Hey, can we take that again?
Nope, that's the one. We talked last week about how like California was burning down, or as the tagline to the 1996-7 maybe disaster film Volcano said, "The West Coast is toast." And I just saw an article online today that said that our carbon emissions are now reached San Diego and up all the way up to Northern California.
Cool.
So how do you like them apples?
I guess I don't know what that means. I feel like carbon emissions are everywhere, right? Or
yeah,
like LA's specifically?
Yeah, like the Southern California fires. I don't know. The graphic just showed like an orange blob that was stretching across all of California.
The carbon emissions from the fires.
Yes.
Sure, I guess. I don't care. Everybody fucking drives a Prius here, so it's not like that doesn't bother me. We did have a couple fires here though in North County, San Diego.
Oh, how cute. How were they?
As far as I know, they were all right. They got them contained in a couple days. I think Ventura's still on fire, so
yeah,
you know.
I think all the fires that we have are still on fire. They're just at various levels of being contained.
Yeah.
Ventura's still the worst. But I like the Skirball, which is the closest one to me, I think it's like 85% contained. That's the one that we were talking about with was close to the Getty Museum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that one was going to be priority because that's where all the mansions are.
Well, it also has the dumbest name.
Yeah, I don't know like where that came from. Maybe it was the last name of the guy who discovered it, Thomas Skirball.
I think it's based off of location.
Maybe.
Because like ours was the Lilac Fire and it took place in Lilac.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, I don't...
A town in north of
I think it's a county. I don't know. I feel like we're being a little glib
about
something that's ravaging our state and destroyed hundreds of homes and displaced people and
100%. Yes.
This episode's starting off weird, Cass.
You're usually the one that takes it to a dark place really fast. Okay.
I mean, I guess that tracks.
For lack of anything else to talk about at the opening of the show, what did you have to talk about?
Not too long ago, I guess actually it was when Beauty and the Beast came out.
Uh-huh.
We did our over-under for Disney movies.
Sure.
And this actually was around Thanksgiving that this happened, but I keep forgetting about it. Ashley and I rewatched The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, the original Disney film. Because we talked about how it had been a long time since we've seen it, and it was both of our least favorites, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was general consensus worst.
Mm-hmm.
Disney. My opinion hasn't really changed.
Hmm.
It's pretty, like, unnecessarily dramatic, and the music isn't that great. It has sort of a Les Mis thing going, where it's more of an operetto.
Right. I remember there being a lot of songs. Even for a kid, I was like, there's a lot of songs.
Well, it's not that there's a lot of songs, per se. It's that there's a lot of singing.
Right.
So there's, like, talk singing, and again, it is sort of this Les Mis thing, which I do think was intentional.
Maybe.
But it doesn't lend itself to Disney cartoon.
It was French, also, and Les Mis was super popular at the time.
Yeah. So I think that, like I said, was sort of a nod. And then it's also, like super religious, which I think it's, like, the only Disney movie that's overtly has any sort of religion attached to it. So that was kind of strange. All in all, it feels like a Fox movie, like when they did Anastasia and shit like that.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone ever called it Anastasia but you just now?
Anastasia.
That reminds me of this horrendous customer I had. Who had to tell me exactly how to bag all of her groceries, and who thought I was trying to rip her off because she put multiple things in one plastic bag and I was just like holding one end to weigh each thing separately. And she referred to the shallots as shallots.
I'm gonna side with her on this one, Cass. You're pronouncing shallots wrong.
No, it's nobody has ever said shallots.
I still think you should rewatch Hunchback, but yeah, definitely. I wasn't really surprised that I wasn't that into it. And I think I do appreciate Hunchback of Notre Dame a little bit on that level of it being a risky move.
Mm-hmm.
Especially after all of these hits in a row, for them to do Hunchback of Notre Dame, where, you know, which is pretty historically grim, is pretty risky. So I can appreciate it on some levels.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't know when or how I could ever see it again, but what did somebody you have know have a DVD or something?
Yeah, we have we have a steelbook of it, and we also watch it. It's on Hulu, so.
Oh, okay. So what we are doing today, officially, is we're going to be discussing Guillermo del Toro's new film, The Shape of the Water, and at the end of the show for our Netflix homework, we're going to talk about the 1994 Christmas comedy, The Ref, but, in preparation, or leading up to our review of Shape of the Water, we are going to do a career retrospective for director-writer Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
So, some I mentioned to you before we started, some of these I haven't seen in a long time. One of these I've never seen officially all the way through. So,
And we're only doing, like, feature-length theatrical releases, right?
Yeah, we're not going to be talking about, like, The Strain or something like that. Or his, like, shorts or whatever. This is just his full-length feature films.
Or Troll Hunters on Netflix.
Right, which I've heard not very good things about, actually.
I think he just produced it.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. But let's start in 1993 with his first feature, Kronos, which is still highly regarded, actually. The Criterion Collection recently released it. It's a vampire story, sort of from a different perspective. I think he's at one point recorded saying that... he wanted to do a vampire film where the central theme wasn't sexuality. So instead, it's a grandfather-granddaughter dynamic in which the grandfather is trying to escape death, turning into a vampire slowly, and the granddaughter...
Well, it's also kind of an accident, right? Like,
yeah.
There's this... it's been a little while since I've seen this one, but it's like this little mechanical... egg spider,
like scarab or something.
Yeah, that attaches to him, and that's what causes the vampirism.
Yeah, which is very different and very, very Guillermo del Toro-y. His like kind of gear punk, steampunk aesthetic is already in place. And the fact that this transmission, again, of you know, because there is something sort of suggestive about, like, Bela Lugosi coming in the night and then, like, you know, bending down to suck on your neck. Mm-hmm. Here he removes even the person-to-person contact with the with a older vampire or something. But I really like this movie. I think it's really quirky. You could definitely tell this is a Spanish film. And you could definitely tell that it has a non-American aesthetic, even from that time. It's very stylish.
It does have Ron Perlman in it, though. Doesn't he
Ron speak Perlman, English? Yep. He speaks English in the movie, yeah. And I think Guillermo del Toro also said something to the effect that he had Ron Perlman essentially playing, like, a American stereotype to Latinos.
You know, it's kind of funny, because now that we're going over Kronos, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of parallels between this and Shape of the Water.
Oh, we'll see that all the way through, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, for sure.
He has his themes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember I really liked this movie. Mm-hmm. Again, it's been a while since I've seen it, since I've watched it, but I remember... It does feel a little dated because it is from 93. Yeah. But it's, you know, I think if you're a fan of his work, it's mm-hmm. worth checking out.
For sure. It also kind of feels a little bit like a Pedro Almodovar film in the sense that it's about serious subject matter, but it kind of has this sort of bouncy light touch to it.
It has a little bit of
a soap opera-ish quality sometimes.
Yeah, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the director you referenced, but yeah, it does have sort of an odd quality like that.
Yeah, and that's I think that amongst, you know, getting bigger budgets and things like that, that kind of slipped away over time.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think just sort of time, you mm-hmm. know, it does date a little. It does feel like a 90s movie.
Right.
You can feel the budget a little bit.
Yeah. Although I think the production design and the creature design of when he's turning, cause it's a very weird kind of look. He's like peeling off his skin to reveal this marble white underneath.
Yeah.
That still looks really cool. Like that's very original and graphic.
Yes. Overall, we're cool movie.
Mm-hmm. Definitely worth looking at. Mimic is the one I've never seen. Now I remember it coming out. Mm-hmm. I remember it, and we talked about off air how everyone always confuses this with Relic, which came out around the same time, 97.
Tom Sizemore in it.
Tom Sizemore in that one, yeah, not Mimic. This is the film that he made through the Weinstein Company, you know, without getting into everything. He said he would never work for Harvey Weinstein again because he famously liked to take foreign directors to make English films and then slice and dice them into something that's unrecognizable by the director.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. So I did see this movie, and mm-hmm. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I do remember it has a very, it feels like a 90s sort of monster thriller.
Mm-hmm.
But the monster itself, I think, is the thing that really stands out.
Sure.
Like, as far as the script and stuff, it's pretty by the numbers, sort of Silence of the Lambs, but there's a monster involved.
Okay.
Kind of thing going on.
I mean, isn't it like these giant like beetle things that are underneath in the sewers? Like,
well, yeah, that's the thing that separates it is mm-hmm. it's a serial killer movie, right? Because the bug looks like a man in a trench coat.
Okay.
That's why it's called Mimic, is because it's like its carapace makes it look like it has a human face. So the creature design is really cool.
Uh-huh.
That's like the one takeaway is it's a pretty by the books, creature feature serial killer thriller.
Uh-huh.
Except for the creature design is exceptional. It's just a really cool take.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it sort of looks like the dude from Jeepers Creepers, but that's like just its thorax kind of thing. It's
right.
Really interesting. But other than that, it's very, this one more so than Kronos feels yeah. its date.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. It's all right. It feels very produced, very studio thriller.
Yeah.
I think that's why it gets confused with Relic so easily.
Right. And it, since then, there has been a director's cut release, but I don't think it's an official director's cut. I think it's just they put in some deleted scenes and called it a director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Guillermo del Toro oversaw it. I don't think he's approved it. I still don't think he's a big fan of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I think you could kind of disclude it from his canon.
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth seeing for like as a completist.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And again, it's got some interesting stuff, but overall, I actually think Relic's a better movie.
Now that movie, I do remember.
I mean, it's not great either. It's
no, it's kind of campy in a fun way though.
Yeah. Mimic isn't really. It's a little overly serious, I think,
for a monster movie.
Yeah.
The Devil's Backbone. Now that he returns back to Spanish language films, we kind of saw this happen with Alfonso Cuarón, where he came to America. He made a couple movies, mm-hmm. The Little Princess. What was that movie called?
I don't know.
And then he something else, and then he went back to Spain to make Y Tu Mama Tambien, which is like his big art house thing, and that got him back into the filmmaking world. Then he comes back to America and makes Children of Men, etc., and so on. And that kind of, I think that is sort of the same trajectory we see here with Devil's Backbone. He returns to Spanish language film to make a movie for him.
Yeah.
And I think this might be like the beginning of like of prestige Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think you could kind of see this as sort of the beginning of him as an auteur.
Mm-hmm. He has a sort of bifurcated career path where he makes one for him and then one and then a few for the studios and then one for him, and we'll see this going through. And you know, Kronos kind of like showed aspirations for both, and I think this one really is like, you know, shaking off the smell of the bad studio experience.
And it's a cool movie. Like it's a ghost mm-hmm. story told in a Spanish orphanage, right
in like the World War One.
One of the world wars.
Might not even be either. It might be like a Spanish specific war.
Yeah, we know there's a bomb in this like orphanage school.
Yeah, a bomb like manages to land and not explode, and it just sits there. And that sort of sets the tone for the whole movie. Is this idea?
Yeah, like they are. It's sort of a metaphor for the ghost,
right?
Mm-hmm. It's just like there's this, you know, sort of unspeakable horror that everyone's aware of that nobody right. really talks about.
Right. And the ghost is actually a metaphor for this, you know, not only the war, but sort of the violence that's hidden from children.
Yeah.
And that's also a cool reoccurring movie. Theme. Yeah, totally cool.
It's also been a while since I've seen this one.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it is a little slower.
Sure.
Than some of his other stuff. This one doesn't really have, because Guillermo del Toro has a bit of a pulp sensibility normally.
Mm-hmm.
But this one doesn't really have that. It's definitely, I think, him sort of trying the hardest, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's him, you know, even though it is a ghost story, it is a genre film.
Mm-hmm.
And he never shies away from that. Even like, you know, when he's getting Oscar nods and that kind of thing, he's still making movies he wants to make.
Yeah.
If he really wanted to win Oscars, he would make, you know, something like a Gravity or something like that, or, you know, or even less genre than that. He could make a historical piece, but he chooses not to do that. He always wants to include his stylistic fetishes
Well, I can't imagine him making a movie that has, like, zero monsters in it.
Right, exactly. I don't think he would want to.
Yeah.
But I do think this one is probably his most sober of his pieces, and it does seem the least... I think it's probably his darkest film.
Yeah, I think it's also the least sort of fantastical.
Mm-hmm. Although there is kind of a fairy tale quality to it with the idea of, like, this boy and then this ghost and sort of what they discover about each other.
It's more of a mystery than a fairy tale, mm-hmm. but it does, I mean, all of his stuff is rooted in folklore somehow.
Yes, or, definitely. Yeah. This also came out around the same time, not too much long after The Sixth Sense, and a little bit before The Others, and there was a lot of these kinds of movies in the air at the time. This idea mm-hmm. of, like, children and ghosts and this sort of mystery element. Kind of in that canon.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's fair to associate it with those, and I think if you like those movies, then you probably enjoy this, although it is a little lower budget than any sure. of the other ones.
But, and less overtly commercial.
Yeah.
But unlike his next film, which really went the other way, another for hire studio gig, Blade 2, which I will say on the record is my favorite Blade movie.
Oh, it's 100% the best Blade movie.
Mm-hmm.
It balances the right amount of comic book and action and humor and weird pulp and some really cool vampire design that I think he kind of ripped himself off with when he did the TV show The Strain.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of the stuff I saw from, like, promo stuff I saw from Strain, I was like, oh, that's Blade 2.
Yeah, he probably went back in his little notebooks that he does all of his sketches in, and is like, you know what, I didn't use some of these.
Yeah. This was before. I mean, this was 2002, so this was sort of before the comic book thing was, like, a super hot property.
Right. So I think at this point we had one X-Men movie. Was this post Spider-Man? Maybe, barely.
I think so. I think Spider-Man was around... I think it was in 2000, 2001.
Right.
It was 2001 because it was post 9/11.
Yeah, there was that whole controversy about the first trailer with the Twin Towers.
Yeah, so this... And I think he kind of got sort of the more modern comic book formula a little ahead of the game of just making a cool genre picture with some very pulpy elements.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see some influence, I think, of the X-Men movies with, like, the Blood Pack and their super awesome, like, badass leather bondage gear.
Oh, yeah. With Ron Perlman as the leader of the gang. He has a shaved head in it. Mm-hmm.
Is this the second Ron Perlman appearance?
I think so far, yeah. Unless he was in Mimic, which I don't know.
No, I don't think he was.
Yeah, this is a fun movie. I'm not going to say it's a great movie. It's certainly the writing is of its time. It's of that early 2000s, like, everything has to be super cool kind of thing. But yeah. I think what does make it work is the production design, is the style of it, the lighting. And it's all very different from the first one, which had this kind of, like, the thesis of the first Blade movie was almost to make it seem, you're keeping in all this kind of post-Matrix, like, you know, techno music and kung fu and all of that stuff. But it almost seemed like the first one was like, what would a vampire culture subculture look like in modern day society?
Oh, yeah.
Whereas one is like full on creature feature.
Yeah, and full-on comic book, too. Like, it's got some crazy action sequences. I will say there is some unnecessary CGI.
Yeah, there's some
bullshits.
Dating CGI in there when he's not using practical. Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because Wesley Snipes, say what you will about him, did some crazy stunts.
Yeah.
And when he does do his martial arts bullshit, it's cool, and there is a lot of practical stunt work,
right?
But there's also, And I think that's why the CGI stands out so much more, is it's like, okay, why didn't they just get someone to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree, though. I think this is the best Blade movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most fun, the most stylized, and has the least amount of wince-worthy moments.
Yeah, that's true. Hellboy came out in 2004, and this was a little bit of a passion project. You know, this was there was a long lead up to there being a Hellboy. This is one of the like modern day comic book boom, kind of pre Marvel whatever.
Yeah, this is him figuring out what worked for Blade 2,
mm-hmm.
And what worked from. It's sort of weird that Hellboy got made before so many of these other comic book properties.
For sure, yeah. And stylistically, it's kind of a conundrum, because it does feel very much like it has a comic book feel to it, more so than even the comic. Mm-hmm. You know, the comic is kind of dark, pulpy, pagan, you know, weirdness, whereas the movie is like, let's take a little bit of Spider-Man and a little bit of, like, something like The Shadow or Rocketeer or whatever, like that mm-hmm. kind of like post Indiana Jones pulpy feel.
Yeah, and but then, that's in the comics too. I mean, that's the thing about Hellboy comics, is there's so many different elements that you could draw from.
Right.
Like there's this 40s pulpy superhero ghost named the Lobster Johnson, who like burns his insignia on criminals and is totally like a shadow spoof character.
Mm-hmm.
So that those elements do exist in the Hellboy comics as well. And it's just this movie sort of chose to focus on that and highlight them.
Right. Rather than making a darker movie, which I guess they're doing with the remake.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens there. But I mean, if you don't love Hellboy, I don't know if I can be your friend. like, I think this movie holds up as still one of the best comic book movies of all time.
Really?
Yeah. I love it.
I like it a whole lot, but I think it's a bit of a shaggy dog. And I've always thought that. I thought that there's, you know, the story is a little all over the place. I think that our lead-in character, our Cypher character, is incredibly boring and doesn't need to be in the movie at all.
Are you talking about Liz?
No.
Oh, no, the FBI agent.
Yeah, the one that you can't remember whose name.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who FBI, didn't even make it
well,
to the
not FBI, BPRD agent.
Right.
Yeah, he was a red shirt. He probably should have been killed off.
Right, but he's our Cypher. He's the center of consciousness for a lot of the movie.
Sure. And
until they decide he's not. And then... And yeah, I think on a screenplay level, it doesn't hold up that well. But I think that the production design of it, the monster design of it, the villain is really cool. This is the first time we really saw straight up Lovecraftian stuff done with this much of a budget and with this much love.
Oh yeah, and the set pieces are awesome. Mm-hmm. Like Cronin in the fucking museum, just like mm-hmm. ripping through dudes with. Like, it's just a cool fucking movie. I mean...
It's cool, yeah.
And this is sort of the last vestige of this type of superhero movie, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess there's a few more.
The kind of pre-MCU.
Yeah.
When there wasn't as many rules, when the formula wasn't as set.
I would actually say the opposite. This is when the formula is much more set.
Oh.
This is when it's like, okay, if you're going to do a superhero movie, this is how you do it. This is superhero script writing sort of 101. I think that MCU breaks away from that, and that's why MCU's done so well. I just think this movie does it so much better than a lot of those movies because of the style.
Oh.
Because Ron Perlman is just at his most charismatic. I mean, there was a huge uproar when Ron Perlman got recast. When David Harbour took the role, because mm-hmm. Ron Perlman just embodied Hellboy. He's the everyman schlub with a mug.
For sure. And that's saying a lot for an actor who's buried under like 40 pounds of makeup.
Oh, yeah. I think this is one of the best performances of Ron Perlman's career, and
probably his most definitive.
Sort of Guillermo del Toro, he's just having so much fun with the creature design. Mm-hmm. And I think he works with Mignola's style so well. I love it. It's a hoot. I mean, yeah, it's not a perfect movie. It's pretty pulpy. But I think if you like movies like The Shadow and The Rocketeer, this is sort of the peak of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 2006, he goes back to Spanish language again with Pan's mm-hmm. Labyrinth. And I would venture to guess this is a lot of people's favorite Guillermo del Toro film. Or what, you know, if we're looking at, like, when he passes away and they have, like, the you know, his movie credits rolling at the Oscars or one of those kind of award shows, this will probably be the images they draw from the most.
Sure. I mean, this is him at his most Guillermo del Toro. This is...
Yeah.
I think this movie combines sort of every aspect of it that we've talked about. This includes the auteur, the Spanish speaking
art house kind of film.
Mm-hmm. This includes some pulpy monster design. This includes a lot of folklore, but it also draws a lot of stuff from like The Devil's Backbone and mm-hmm. his more sort of
this kind of more somber, introspective kind of thing. This is sort of a Alice in Wonderland
yeah.
type of narrative.
But it's set in the Spanish Civil War.
We're so bad with history. And we probably would have helped to at least read some of these synopses first. But
So it's set in Spain in 1944 is what IMDb says.
Right. So there is a war happening. And the girl who is in question... her mother is in a relationship with...
I'm going to go on record and say that that is sort of a testament of Guillermo del Toro as a filmmaker, because mm-hmm. I don't know anything about Spanish history, really. I barely have a grasp on English or American history. Mm-hmm. But I still connect with these movies, not because I relate to them culturally, but because... he's able to tell these stories on at least an emotional enough level that I can relate.
Sure. Yeah, 100%. But yeah, so the girl, she's her mother is married to this like crazy evil general, and she's essentially, I mean, it's left open to interpretation, but she's essentially creating this escape in her mind of mm-hmm. trying to solve this riddle or this mystery of trying to go to this magic land where she's supposed to be the princess. And along the way, she sees all these crazy creatures and these, these insane monsters. I think this has his scariest scene in a movie, which is the Pale Man.
The Pale Man, yeah.
Played by Doug Jones, not the Doug Jones that just won the Alabama Senate race, but... longtime collaborator and is often plays his creatures.
He also plays the Fawn.
Yes, yes. And Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he often plays his creatures because mm-hmm. I think he was the mother ghost in Crimson Peak as well.
Oh, you might be right. Yeah. But yeah, I love this movie. Obviously, I think it. It's the perfect balance between serious and sort of fantasy elements, and you know, historical elements, fantasy elements, pulp elements, horror elements.
Yeah, this is him, I think, firing on all his engines.
Yeah,
I think it sort of combines everything he loves, and it is one of his most succinct as well. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, and we'll see this, I think, in a few of his later movies.
Right.
I think he kind of trips over the script a mm-hmm. little bit because he's such a visual director. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think he can lose track of the human characters, like in the case of Hellboy. You know, he's so much more interested in the monsters that sometimes I think that can be a bit problematic for him, but not in this case. No, not at all. I think the perfect balance of monster to human empathy.
I think you
also, I mean, also, I think this is the movie that made a lot of people pay attention to Guillermo del Toro, whereas before that, you know, like he was sort of known for Blade 2 and Hellboy and the sort of comic book fare. This is the one that I think made critics go, who the fuck is this guy?
Right. I don't think, you know, and Devil's Backbone was a little bit of an indie hit or whatever, but I don't think a lot of people really looked at that movie until Pan's Labyrinth did well. And then they realized, oh, this guy's been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think what you said about, you know, the problems with his later work, I think that goes really well into a discussion of Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
God damn it. Nope.
Oh, you're still all in.
I'll say this
about Hellboy 2. I like it for all the reasons I stated about Hellboy 1. It looks cool. You know, Ron Perlman and Abe Sapien. Great performances. Love the relationship there. I think it's even more of a Shaggy Dog than the first one. The villain is pretty weak. And almost kind of like a proto guy with a weird face Marvel villain.
Yes and no. I'm going to fight you on Hellboy 2.
Okay. I'm not saying it's a bad movie, by the way. I do enjoy it. I just think...
I think the difference, though, is that, yes, Prince Nuada is kind of forgettable, but he treats the villain at least with an empathy that I don't think a lot of other weird dude with a face characters do.
Yeah.
Like the movie goes to great pains to sort of show you at least his point of view. Definitely he's an extremist. He's an extremist elf prince. But
there's Guillermo a little bit of a there's a little bit of like a Phantom of the Opera quality to him. Like he's doing bad things, but the movie gives him a lot of empathy.
Something that you'll see time and time again with, and I don't think we've mentioned a movie yet that excludes itself from this rule, is Guillermo del Toro's capacity for empathy.
Right.
Even the most mustache twirling of villains, you're going to get at least a sense of why they're doing it, of their motivation.
Right.
Even as, you know, Rasputin from Hellboy 1, as villainous as you can get, a Russian Nazi cult leader, you are at least seeing his point of view a little bit.
Right.
And I think that's somewhere Guillermo del Toro excels, is his capacity for empathy. Again... honestly, I think the only problem with this movie is the Hellboy, Liz Sherman, romance subplot. And that's sort of the big problem with the first Hellboy, is he goes to such lengths to humanize the character that it's sort of, sometimes what we're watching the movie for, Hellboy, takes a back seat because it's we got to humanize him. We got to make him relatable, which I don't need. But that being said, I rewatched this not too long ago and was surprised how much it held up and how much fun I had with it. In the whole, and they do introduce a love interest for Abe Sapien, and that is so fun. And
that
good.
Pays off. I remember that working really well. I just thought that the movie was kind of episodic. Like, it's just sort of a bunch of stuff happening. Like, he just kind of goes from one weird set piece to another, and then we meet another weird thing, and then another weird thing. And it doesn't feel as tightly structured or like it has a direction as story-wise.
As much as the first one, yeah, I will agree with that. It does kind of meander a little bit, and I think part of that is again, finding this mixture of being beholden to the comics, like they introduce Johann Kraus.
Mm-hmm. Whose voice is that? It's Seth MacFarlane, right? It's
Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah.
And he adds a lot of life to the character. He sort of does a Family Guy voice, but right. I think it works. You know, and sort of like, okay, what are we going to include from the comics versus what sort of mythology am I going to go on my own? Uh-huh. And so I do think there's a little bit of friction there.
Yeah.
That maybe could have been smoothed out. But I think this is one of his most fun movies.
Yeah, for sure.
I think maybe even more so than the first Hellboy. Like, there's this the whole set piece with the troll market. Oh. And the creature design is one of his most memorable because you have the Angel of Death.
Mm-hmm.
You have all these sort of side monsters. The little tooth fairies.
Oh, yeah. Every monster he could ever think of is in this movie.
Yeah. And that's super fun. It's definitely not prestigious like Pan's Labyrinth.
No.
That's the thing I like about Guillermo del Toro, though, is even at his most sort of studio produced, he does manage to add these levels of character.
Personality.
Yeah, that I think a lot of big budget blockbusters don't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What did you think of Pacific Rim? I would probably say it's fine. I think it's kind of forgettable, though. Like, to me, this is the one of his, like, especially of his blockbusters movies, mm-hmm. that has the least amount of the personality of him that I like. Like, it has cool creatures, has cool robots. I think that it's a little empty. And I almost want to say, like, if I were to see it again, I almost mm-hmm. want to say, like, the movie might have been trying to say something about that in blockbusters, like, because this is like the peak of like the Transformers thing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have even been commenting on that. I'm not sure. I just know that the human characters in this really fall flat, with the exception of
Idris Elba.
No, he's pretty terrible in the movie.
We are canceling the apocalypse. You kid me?
Rinko Kikuchi.
Yeah,
she's really great in the movie. But everybody else, Charlie Hunnam and Idris Elba and everybody is almost like, that's what I'm saying. Maybe it's intentional. It reminds me a little bit of like the overacting what's that one Paul Verhoeven bug movie?
Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
That movie's amazing. Don't you say a bad word about that movie.
No, but that movie is satire. I'm not so sure that, Pacific Rim is.
No, I don't. Okay, there's a couple things. One, I do think Charlie Hunnam isn't the most exciting actor, and he's our lead, and that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I think the movie mm-hmm. would have been much more interesting had he not been in it, had it just been about the girl.
Rinko Kikuchi?
Yeah. I thought she was a much more interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Idris Elba, but I could watch Idris Elba read a goddamn phone book. I think also there's some weird humor that might not necessarily play, like with Charlie Hunnam and the German dude.
Oh, you mean Charlie Day?
Charlie Day, yes, Charlie.
Yeah, actually, those characters are fun. I mean, I like all of that, and even, you know, Ron Perlman is like this gangster, black market monster parts dealer.
I love his character.
All of that.
Ron Perlman in this movie is sort of a reprise of his character from Kronos.
Kind of, yeah, totally,
but 100%. Taken even more to the extreme.
Mm-hmm. I like all of that stuff, but I feel like it comes from another movie. It doesn't feel in concert with all of the big blockbuster stuff. Like,
I'm gonna kind of agree with you on this. Mm-hmm. I do think this is one of his more cold movies. Like, it's definitely a little detached.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it makes up for it in spades with giant robot versus monster action. you get a lot of it, and it's really cool. And it's got a badass score by Ramin Djawadi, who did the same score for not Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones.
Okay.
I mean, this is, it's kind of a big pulpy mess, but that's sort of what I love about it. And again, even though it's a big pulpy mess, there is this love that Guillermo del Toro has for the genre that sort of translates. I'm a little worried that the sequel isn't going to have that because it's it doesn't have him.
Right.
I think say what you will about him because he can be pretty detached from the human characters, and I think this is sort of that in its worst. But he has such a love for the genre he's working in that there's still a beating heart underneath it, where a lot of blockbusters don't have that.
For sure. And you know, I had fun watching this. I don't think I could watch it again on like DVD or something. I think like the theater experience kind of makes or breaks this one.
I've wanted to rewatch it again, just because I remember it being really fucking cool, and that was kind of enough for me.
You've talked about it already. How excited would you be for a sequel not directed by him?
I'm not super excited, which bums me out. Like just from the trailer. I've seen for the second one, it feels a little, I don't feel that sort of love that you get from Guillermo del Toro. I don't feel the passion that he has for the monsters and for the robots. And again, for the genre, like this is him doing, he does his version of monster movies. This is him doing his Godzilla. This, you know, Pan's Labyrinth was him doing Alice in Wonderland, Blade 2 and Kronos were him doing vampires. So again, I'm pretty hesitant about the sequel. And another thing about this that a lot of blockbusters don't have is I really feel the stakes. Like by the end of it, you know, a lot of characters die off and get horribly murdered, and it always feels like fighting the monsters is a struggle. And to me, that is another thing that adds to this versus like the Transformers, where it's like, you know, they're gonna win, and if they don't, okay. But this is like, oh shit, like it really feels like the world is ending because there's giant monsters attacking.
And again, creature designs are really cool. The fight sequences are really cool. The mechanics of like how the Jaegers, the giant robots, work is really cool. And it's stuff we've seen in anime forever, but we've never seen like translated to the screen so seamlessly.
Yes. For all of these reasons, I like Pacific Rim. Is it a complex character study? No. You know, Hellboy has way more character. This is a movie filled with the BPRD agent that I don't really care that much about.
Right. Yeah.
And that is a problem. I'll admit that. But this movie is just so much damn fun that I want to watch it again. I've actually wanted to watch it again for a while.
Yeah. Now, I don't think I've ever talked to you about Crimson Peak, because I will put it on the record. And that's what I was going to say about Pacific Rim, but I changed my mind. This is my least favorite Guillermo del Toro film. Now, a little bit of lead up. Crimson Peak was came out during a time where Guillermo del Toro had a lot of plates spinning. He was almost going to make a lot of different things. He was almost going to make a Pinocchio movie, which he still might. He was almost going to make a Frankenstein reboot. He was almost going to do a Haunted Mansion movie for Disney. And I have a feeling like a lot of what we're seeing in Crimson Peak came from his early production in that. This is also around the time that he was originally attached to do the first Hobbit film, and then got kicked off the project, quit the project, whatever happened there.
Well, this is also, there were a lot of movies between that he was like in pre-production for between Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak, because there was also
in the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, which fucking Prometheus fucked up for everybody.
Maybe, yeah. Now, what we ended up with was Crimson Peak, which is a pretty standard kind of gothic horror romance.
I'm not going to call it standard.
Well, I mean, it has idiosyncrasies, but, you know, as far as the genre goes, you know, a Victorian-style gothic horror, and it has some kind of soap opera-ish twists along the way. I just found myself very unengaged by any of it. I didn't think any of it was that scary. I liked the production design, but I almost felt like it was almost overwhelmed the already thin plot points and characters. Yeah, this is the one of his I would definitely probably never have to see again.
See, I really liked it. I know a lot of people didn't. I think this is one of his most critically derided, actually. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that comes from the actors. Mm-hmm. It is a gothic romance.
Yeah.
And it feels like gothic romantic fiction. And right. To me, I feel like he achieves that because a lot of gothic romantic fiction isn't about the characters. I feel like a lot of them are pretty two-dimensional, and I feel that in this. I think he succeeds at what he sets out for, though. I don't think he should work with Charlie Hunnam anymore. Because he's not an actor's director, and I feel like Charlie Hunnam is an actor who needs to be directed.
Mm-hmm. He's not even a big part of this movie, though.
No, like, but
it's really the Mia Wasikowska and Tom Hiddleston.
I feel kind of the same with Mia Wasikowska, whereas mm-hmm. Tom Hiddleston he's hamming it up. He is him and Jessica Chastain are super vampy. They feel right out of one of those, what do they call them?
Flowers in the Attic, like, Lifetime kind of things.
I was going to say, the like, romance novels.
Dime Store kind of, like, romance novels?
Yeah, yeah. And, I feel like they're right out of that. And I feel like that's what they should be. The characters are kind of two-dimensional. I think Mia
Wasikowska.
I think she's pretty unremarkable. And I think that's unfortunate because I think a lot of the movie sort of is weighted on her. But I loved the production design.
Everybody does.
Yeah, I think no matter what, when you say it's like overly produced, I'm like, I could watch the movie again just to watch them walk around in their dresses on that set.
But that's the thing. I think there's the movie is almost so visually considered or driven. None of the sets really feel that lived in. It looks like it's a big Halloween production, and everyone's in their costumes. So they're like at best, the movie just kind of comes off as campy.
It reminded me a lot of Bram Stoker's Dracula, actually.
Sure, which is a little campy as well, but I think that one takes a more stylistic risk.
I actually kind of enjoyed that from this movie. Like it feels like a Halloween movie. To me, that's not like. I think the problem was sort of the expectation of this movie. I think people were wanting Pan's Labyrinth 2. And it's not that. This is a very specific type of ghost story that's very different from the type of ghost story he was telling with The Devil's Backbone. Right. This has some cheesecake factor to it. And I think, to me, it worked. I really enjoyed it. I actually really liked this movie. I know not a lot of people did, but I thought this would be in my Halloween rotation.
Okay. All right. I think what you said about expectation is big, too, for me, and I think for a lot of people. You know, we're seeing almost like a peak with Pan's Labyrinth, and then it seems like every film he's made after that, there's some diminishing returns.
And
as far as what he's capable of doing.
I think he plays to the genre so well that that's the thing. It's still a genre picture, and so the fact that Crimson Peak wasn't a prestige film like Pan's Labyrinth, I think, threw people off and was, you know, probably disappointing to people. But if you compare this, to, I think, any other aspect of his work, we're seeing the same thing. It's just people are noticing it a lot more because a lot more of it does sort of hinge on these human characters.
Yeah, and you know what? I think this is definitely the movie he wanted to make. It doesn't feel like it was marred by, you know, studio interference or anything like that. He might have been a little busy during the pre-production period, and maybe some consideration to the screenplay wasn't as there as it could have been. But, you know, at the end of the day, I do think he made the movie he wanted to make. But I know for me personally, it started to feel like, gee, it's been a while since we've seen a good Guillermo del Toro film. And by good, I mean, you know, as good as we can expect from him.
Well, okay, so this came out in 2015, and Pan's Labyrinth came out in 2006.
Sure.
And I think that's exactly what people felt, was they were like, after Seemed Pan's like Labyrinth, he does Hellboy 2, he does Pacific Rim, it's like, okay, what's he doing? But to me, I'm like, yeah, giant monsters, or yeah, Troll Market, or yeah, like, fucking give me a good-ass gothic ghost story. Name one other movie that's like that in the past decade that's good, that's of quality.
I mean, you're putting me on the spot. I'm sure I could come up with something, but yes, I, you know, the fact that he made this kind of Jane Eyre-ish kind of,
but with ghosts. I think the worst thing I can say about it is, yeah, the script, a lot of the dialogue's pretty wooden.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it sort of feels like someone who's wrote it, who it feels like it didn't quite get translated to English properly.
Yeah.
I think when
I reviewed this with Richard, we sharply disagreed on it. And I think he almost said something similar, was like, maybe this is a situation, and to compare it to a film, although it's not supernatural, but has kind of a similar vibe.
Mm-hmm.
There was this movie that Park Chan-wook made in English called Stoker, which had this kind of melodramatic soap opera-ish feel as well. But we both really liked that movie, and even though a lot of people didn't, because they thought that like his style of tension brought to the English language was jarring and weird.
Yeah, I think absolutely that is happening here. And an actor like Charlie Hunnam doesn't know how to make that sound natural.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know how to translate it to English. He's just reading the lines on the page.
Right.
Whereas if maybe there was a little more improvisational quality to it, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I don't think he's the kind of director who's like really into that.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but see, like, compare him to Tom Hiddleston, who I was all about. I felt like he was just vamping it up and having, he feels like he's doing a stage production of Frankenstein or...
Well, this does kind of have a British Hammer sort of quality to it.
Yeah, and that's... These are all things I liked about it. I get why people didn't, per se, but I think they were wanting it to be not the movie that it was.
Maybe it deserves a reevaluation. Maybe I'll look at it again at some point. But we got to move on. We got to talk about his new film, which just came out. That is The Shape of the Water, and I'm going to let you set that up.
Okay, so this is set in like the 50s or the 60s, Cold War era. Mm-hmm. I guess probably the 60s because they're talking about the space program.
Civil rights and stuff.
Yeah, Cold War era America. Sally Hawkins plays Eliza, a mute janitor at this undercover super secret government facility. Mm-hmm. And she discovers they bring in a creature, a mer creature, like the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Fish person, sure.
Fish person. He's credited as the amphibian man. And she develops an attachment to him and eventual romance. And she feels that she has to help him escape from this government facility. Because as most government facilities are wont to do, they want to dissect him for science.
Right. Michael Shannon plays the villain here, doing, you know, a big villainous Michael Shannon performance. And I'll say this about Michael Shannon. He is one of the few people out there who can almost do a literal mustache twirling villain and still pull it off with nuance. Like, yes. He can go this big.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's him at his most Michael Shannon.
Right. He has, like, 1,000 tics. He has, like, rotting fingers. He has a cattle prod. He chews hard candy. Like, he is full of affectations, and I still believe him as a human being.
He's basically playing the same character he played in Boardwalk Empire. Also, like, he's a typical God-fearing, red-blooded American man.
Right.
And there's definitely some commentary going on there.
Yes, there is.
We've also got Richard Jenkins as Eliza's gay next-door neighbor and best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And Octavia Spencer as her black female janitor friend.
Yes.
And then we've got Michael Stuhlbarg. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Sure. Also from Boardwalk Empire.
As a sympathetic doctor, and I don't know if it's a spoiler.
Yes, it is. Anything you say about him is. Okay. And Doug Jones returns as the amphibian man.
Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of the main cast. There's a couple smaller parts in there, but this is... It's mostly about these, six characters?
Mm-hmm.
And how their stories sort of revolve around... Sally Hawkins, I'm sorry, discovery of this amphibian man and her eventual falling in love with him.
Right. So there's a few things about this movie that kind of surprised me going in.
There's a lot that surprised me about this this movie, the fact that it got a mainstream theatrical release is based solely on Guillermo del Toro's name.
100%. Yeah, like, this is
like this one movie of the is most, insane.
This movie is overtly weird, and in a very unintentional way. Like, I mean, intentional, unintentional. I don't know. You can make up your mind about that. Because on a genre level, on a story level, we've seen movies like this before. This is pretty similar structurally to The Iron Giant. This is pretty similar structure to.
Oh, I mean, if we're talking plot structure, it's the exact same plot as Free Willy.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of like this type of movie before. So
remember that movie about the seal, Andre?
Mm-hmm.
It's Andre if she fucked the seal.
there's your poster quote. but yeah, I think what sets this apart from the from what is kind of a common narrative structure. Is the eccentricities of everything else, the specificity of the characters. This, and you know, we've been talking a lot about like Guillermo del Toro's deficit in being able to do human characters. I think he's doing it really well here, and probably maybe better than ever before.
I heard someone say this is him at his, even though it's about a merman. Mm-hmm. This is him at his most human. And I agree with that.
At least since Devil's Backbone or Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, this is the most he really cares about characters other than the monster.
Right. And of course the monster is a great monster. And
you know, let's talk about that for just a second. Because I mean, say what you will about Guillermo del Toro. You cannot say a single bad word about his creature design.
You can't.
Ever.
No.
No, he even the movies where he uses more CGI, there's still a tactile, very designed physical quality to them. They they feel real, and this is no exception. I remember from the trailers, I was like, okay, it's just Abe Sapien, but there's so much more subtlety and nuance. He looks very different from Abe Sapien, and like, how do you do two different creature from the Black Lagoon style characters that look vastly different? I don't know, but he did it, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and you know, Doug Jones is an actor who's in the suit.
Who also played Abe Sapien.
Yes. He looks, he brings a lot of like physicality to the role. Doesn't just look like a guy in a suit.
I think that's important, an important quality. Yeah. Is he, he feels like a living, breathing creature. He moves in a way that's not human, but that still feels real.
Yes, absolutely. But going back to surprises.
Yeah.
I didn't know this was R-rated. I mean, I didn't look into it, you know, because that's not something I generally think about before I go into a movie, unless somebody mentions it specifically.
Other than,
but I went in, the first like scene is a sequence of her like getting ready for a day and masturbating in a bathtub. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, and, this is an R-rated film.
Yeah, and
we're going there.
I actually think, other than the Hellboy movies and maybe Pacific Rim, I think all of his movies have been rated R.
Possibly, even though I don't, they don't register as that to me. Even though,
well, it's not a, it's not something he does for shock value.
Yeah,
and I mean, you could maybe say that with some of his violence, because his violence is always visceral. Like you said, Michael Shannon gets a couple fingers removed early on in the film, and it's bloody and violent and gross.
Oh, and there's some shocking violence throughout, and it kind of comes unexpectedly, but I think that's what he does really well. You know, he could, because this movie could be very arch in a in a Crimson Peak-ish sort of way, because there's a lot of production design. You know, there's a lot of this kind of gauzy, sort of sepia-toned memory of the 60s, or sort of the postcard look of the 60s. And you could definitely remove this movie, like if any other director, like American director, like some schlocky Chris Columbus type, were to do this movie, it would be that much more removed. It would be, you know, everything would be Robin's Egg Green, and it would just be this kind of fantasy and whatever. But the fact that we have him doing it, we're always, he plays it big and he plays it arch, but then there's these moments that bring it right down to a human core.
I think in a way that Crimson Peak doesn't.
Didn't. Yes.
Yeah. I don't think that was sort of the point of Crimson Peak, but I think that was entirely the point of this. I mean, this whole movie is about, like, really these characters, besides Michael Shannon, all have some sort of other quality about them. You've got, well, at least considered other in 1960s America. You've got, you know, a fucking fish man, a black woman.
Yes.
A mute woman. Sally Hawkins' character, she can't speak.
And
she's
Latino.
Literally is voiceless in a white male world. And we've got Richard Jenkins, who's gay.
Yeah, this movie has a strong social justice aspect to it. Well, and I know that some people like really cringe at that term, but and when we're talking about 1960s and we're talking about the times of the civil rights, we're talking about a period of time where everything changed.
Yes.
Movie's about that.
Yes, exactly. I want to also emphasize that it's not just social justice for the sake of social justice. It's, again, it's all about the concept of other. Because a lot, if you look at a lot of the like Universal monster movies, a lot of them are based out of some kind of folklore, which is based off of fear or superstition that is usually surrounded around a group of people. So like take the original vampire design of like Nosferatu, for example. Some people think that the character design was specifically meant to illustrate Jews.
Fair enough.
And so there's a lot of that sort of subtext in those old monster movies that were sort of this period, predate this period even, of like, you know, don't go out at night because the wolfman will get you, but
right.
That's just a metaphor for people of color or whatever.
But in the case of the Universal movies, if we're talking about that, a lot of mm-hmm. the big thing about the big common theme of the, at least the first wave of the Universal horror films, was the sympathetic monster. You know, Frankenstein's yes, creature
is a sympathetic monster, but it's mm-hmm. still a monster. It's a sympathetic monster. In this movie, it's stripping the monster aspect completely away. And he's just another character. He's just another person.
And there is this there's this theme here. You talk about, you know, these characters of come from these diverse backgrounds. There's this kind of this theme of them like creating a family,
mm-hmm.
you know, for themselves, and you know, not being able to fit in with normal society and sort of creating this. Even Michael Stuhlbarg, who has his own things, sort of enters into that a little bit.
Yeah, and. I actually saw this last night. We were going to review this. We were going to record last night, but I wasn't sure mm-hmm. if I'd be able to make it in time. And I'm glad I was able to let it stew a little bit because there were some things, like, upon my initial viewing of it, like, I did think that the romance between Sally Hawkins and the Amphibious Man happened kind of quickly.
Maybe, this is what you're about to say, but it's almost like he wants to get that out of the way quickly. Like, he's like, yeah, they're in love. This is what the movie's going to be, but also all this other stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. At first I was like, felt like the pacing was a little weird at the beginning. But going back to my point about all of these characters being in the same category of other. They're all mm-hmm. separated from Michael Shannon's character, a 1960s American ideal white male who has the typical 60s family, but is completely
the typical
miserable.
60s car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The movie goes to great pains to paint him as the literal American dream. Mm-hmm. And he is on his own, and he is the real monster. But even that, again, this is why I love Guillermo del Toro. He's got that beating heart. Even though mm-hmm. he's the monster, and the movie literally calls him that, it's sort of not his fault. Like, there's a moment, again, maybe this is getting a little spoilery. I don't think so. Where the general straight up tells him, you know, feeds him his motivation.
Right.
And straight up says, like, oh, that's bullshit. Like, you're a soldier. You have to get this done or you're right. useless. He straight up strips the American dream away from him.
And that also returns to a theme of Guillermo del Toro's of, you know, these kind of fantasies during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
Where he talks about sort of the mechanization or the normalization of violence through means of war,
mm-hmm.
and how that sort of undercuts the human relationships of that we should be normalizing.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, I was glad I got to stew on it a little bit because there were so many levels that I sort of found myself discovering with this movie. I think this might be his most textured movie.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean,
there's certainly a lot. There's a lot going on here, and like you can view it on lots of different levels. I think if you're mm-hmm. someone who's like a teenager or whatever, you might be able to see it as just basically a modern sort of Beauty and the Beast thing,
yeah,
and enjoy it on that level. I think if you're watching it from a historical perspective, from, you know, a sociological perspective, you can enjoy it on that level. I think if you're like a horror fan or, you know, Guillermo del Toro, like pulp fan, you'll enjoy it on that level. I think this is him. He's back. This is him on all cylinders.
Yeah. And also, the performances are so great. I mean, he
yes.
got such great actors, though. Sally Hawkins. Ooh. I mean, she literally doesn't have any lines in the movie, but she can just melt your heart with a look.
She's so good. Yeah.
Richard Jenkins takes a character that could have been played very broadly, and insulting, and I thought played it with remarkable sensitivity. Octavia Spencer, her character, again, at the beginning is a little broad, but they show you enough of her backstory that you're like, oh, shit, okay. Like, she is more than this.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about with, like, the... You know, and a lesser director would just go the easy route on all these characters and just play them as broad as a movie almost introduces them and then sort of deconstructs them as it goes.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It's like at first you're just sort of presented them as, well, he's a gay man and, you know, she's a black woman and he's an amphibious man. But I think the movie gives their relationships the same amount of respect. And for this movie to work on that level, like, that has to be there.
Now, let's get into the subject that I think this could be a make it or break it for some people. Because I think the movie generally wants to play to a fairly wide audience. But what about the interspecies erotica of this movie? Do you think this is going to squick out middle America?
Here's the thing. I think the people that it's going to squick out generally probably won't see this. And I also sort of don't care.
No, but I mean, on a large... Is this too weird for the Oscars? Is this too weird for like, a normal movie-going audience? Do you think that people are going to make this connection? Because, like I said, this is essentially Beauty and the Beast, except for Beauty and the Beast cuts away for all the sex scenes.
Yeah, it doesn't actually explicitly state that Belle had sex with a warthog man. she has sex with it. And I think one of the reasons it works for me in this movie is the movie isn't obsessed with it. It doesn't linger on it. It's not about the sex. That just sort of happens. The characters fall in love and it happens. It's not, it's not overly concerned with the mechanics, although there's a fun little moment there.
Yeah. Cause I think we're all kind of thinking it. And so they go over it.
Yeah. But it doesn't, the movie's not obsessed with it. It doesn't care. It's like it happened. So for me, it didn't treat it as weird. So I never thought of it as weird. You know what I mean? You could say the same thing. You could make the same argument about the gay character. Like, in the 1960s.
Sure.
And you get sort of that viewpoint with his character, which I think is important to the movie. Yes. He's literally treated as the same type of monster as the amphibious man. And so
but then we kind of get into some kind of murky territory of comparing homosexuality to bestiality.
But here's the thing.
I'm not saying that Guillermo del Toro is doing that, but I'm saying that argument it kind of leads to problematic territory.
I think someone watching the movie, I think that depends on how you see the amphibious man. Yeah. If you see him as an animal, then yes.
I think actually more importantly, it's how you see Sally Hawkins.
No.
Because, I mean, I don't want to give things away, but, you know, things happen in the movie. And they're put on a more of an equal playing field.
Sure.
Also, it's also very allegorical.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And that's what I mean. I think the way it's portrayed in the movie, he's not portrayed as an animal. He's portrayed as a... He's just as human as us. He just has a different body. He has a heart. He has feelings. He's able to communicate. To me, it was not problematic at all. I didn't even really give it a second thought. And I think the movie...
I didn't give it a second of thought as whether or not it was problematic. But I was thinking, and we stated this at the beginning of the review, this is pretty weird. And this is pretty kinky stuff.
Sure. But I loved that about it. I loved that it wasn't afraid to go there.
Yeah.
That it wasn't tiptoeing on eggshells about the romance. You know, we weren't left to think, I wonder if they had sex. It was like, yeah, no, that was part of it. And the way it dealt with it, compare their sex scene to Michael Shannon with his wife.
Oh yeah.
Where that is more pornographic. He's mm-hmm. literally silencing her. It's more violent. There's no love in that. And with Sally Hawkins, we're not obsessed over the physical act. It's all about the relationship between the two characters.
Right.
Their lovemaking is so much more beautiful than Michael Shannon's.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important aspect to see of the film, is he thinks of his life in a certain way that he's like, okay, this is exactly what I'm supposed to have, even though it's not what I want.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, he becomes a monster.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think this is a terrific movie. I think it is one of the best movies of the year. I think this is one of Guillermo del Toro's best films in a long time. I give it a solid A. I don't know where you are with it.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it was just so much fun to see him sort of letting go as a director. Like, there's mm-hmm. some sequences in this that are a lot more surrealist than he typically gets. Even though his stuff often deals with metaphor and allegory, mm-hmm. it's still like what you're seeing is the is what you're getting kind of thing. Whereas this, there's some playful moments where he's playing with the way he tells the story. It's not just a straight up story, if that makes sense.
I get you.
Last night I would have given it an A. I think today I'm giving it an A+.
Nice.
Better Beauty and the Beast movie than we got from the Disney version.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Okay, now to the Netflix homework and we'll wrap up. The Ref, 1994, directed by Ted Demme, this famous, well-known Christmas comedy. This is an annual for some people. I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a farce. Stars Dennis Leary as a burglar named Gus, who is on the run. He's being pursued by the police. He runs into Judy Davis and Kevin Spacey as Caroline and Lloyd, this sort of uppity suburban couple who are on the verge of a divorce and are constantly arguing about their marriage. They're in couples therapy and it's not going very well. He gets in the wrong car when he tries to take them hostage, and he essentially has to babysit them and their terrible marriage overnight while he's hiding from the police. And of course, Caroline and Lloyd are expecting guests. Their family is going to come over and have a big Christmas dinner, sort of the major set piece of the film. What did you think of The Ref?
So I'm clicking through the pictures on IMDb. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the British release, the European release, it was called Hostile Hostages, which I think is a much better name.
Yeah, why is this called The Ref? Did they ever mention that?
No, I think it's that he's sort of acting as a referee for their marriage. It's sort of a stretch.
Yeah,
it's a piece. But I kind of feel like that's pretty indicative of the whole movie.
Mm.
I felt like the whole movie was sort of a stretch. It's very dated. This is like, I think, the most 1994 movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. You're right. This movie's supposed to be a farce.
Yeah.
But it's just not, to me, it just wasn't funny enough to really be a farce. It's not physical enough or broad enough. And I felt like it was just kind of boring for most of it. Like, I get that they're an unhappy couple, but it sort of feels like, was this a Miramax movie?
No, I don't think so.
It sort of feels like that sort of Miramax sentimentality of being so real it's funny.
Right.
But also at the same time, there's some real tonal issues. Like, at the beginning of the movie, Dennis Leary's breaking into this house, and he gets caught by this weird, like, 90s security contraption that right. has him slide down into the basement, and there's a dog there. And it's like, okay, so that feels like a scene out of Home Alone or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Mm-hmm.
But then their fighting is pretty raw and realistic. So it just, to me, there's a huge tonal imbalance in this movie.
You know what I thought the whole time I was watching this? This feels like a stage play. Like, there's
no,
like,
see,
there's sequences feels... in the movie. Like, I mean, I know there's a lot of like changes of the set, but there's all these, especially the dinner sequence and things like that, where it feels like character enters stage left, character enters stage right. You know, the kid comes home, and the way to deal with that, and it's like the dialogue is very, very stylized in that, and the way they scream over each other. And the way where the breaks are in it, it feels very, you know, the movie it reminded me of the most, which was also another 90s farce that mm-hmm. is beloved and I don't 100% understand why, was The Birdcage. It has that same kind of quality to it.
See, I remember, I have fonder memories of The Birdcage because at least it was funny.
I think The Birdcage is better, I'll say that, and that might have
see,
been a
to me,
film,
I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. This sort of feels like a screenwriter who had aspirations to be a stage writer, or possibly is. I don't know.
Written by Richard
Lagravanis.
Yes,
I don't know.
He wrote a lot of things. He wrote The Fisher King, which is a great.
Oh,
film,
he wrote the last wrote, 5 years.
Or the movie
that makes
version of it.
A lot of sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's a famous gay screenwriter who has a camp quality to a lot of the stuff that he does. But I feel like this movie,
I think that's the problem.
It's almost
with this,
like, teetering on too broad or not broad enough.
I think it's completely doing that. I don't think it's almost doing that. I think the tone is all over the place.
Yeah.
We've got these two characters who are fighting who are even by the end are pretty unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
And mixed with this sort of weird Dennis Leary star vehicle, but mm-hmm. he gets sidelined for a good chunk of the script. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work as a revolving doors farce because it's a movie and because the set changes so much. Like, some of the gags are all about how, you know, they have to go into the kitchen to explain that they're actually hostages, which don't right. really work with camera cuts.
Mm-hmm.
That works when you have a set and it's literally you're seeing these characters only divided by a thin wall,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of shout speaking to each other. It doesn't work when we've got camera cuts and editing. To me, this movie fell pretty flat.
Yeah, that's what I meant when I said it felt like a stage play. I meant like it felt like it should have been a stage play because a lot of the way that it's blocked and edited is stagey.
Yeah.
And that's bad for a movie.
Yes. But I also think it wouldn't really work as a stage play because I just didn't think it was that well written.
No, I mean, you know, there is a rhythm to the dialogue and the way that it's delivered that I can respect. But I don't think it's just not that funny, just ever.
No. It's of an era where it feels like it at the same time wants to be totally relatable, like a Home Alone, Christopher Columbus 90s movie.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure this was sold at the time as the adult Home Alone.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Also, it wants to be edgy and adult, but it doesn't really go hard enough either way to mm-hmm. work either way.
Yeah. And it never feels real, so you can't really, it's not like it's like really digging into any like human condition. So yeah, I'll give Dennis Leary a little bit of props because I think he helps ground a lot of this. I think
what his character was, for what his actual function is in the story, mm-hmm. he's not given a lot to do.
No, he's essentially shows up to be Dennis Leary.
Yeah, and they don't eat, but that's what I mean. They don't even really let him be Dennis Leary to the most effect. Just look at his sort of rambling monologue at the very end when when he's on the boat.
That's the biggest nod to his comedy career at the time.
Yes. Why was that? There not scenes like that throughout. Why was there?
I think I'm actually okay with that. I think if we'd had that all throughout, that could have been pretty obnoxious. I think his essential function in the movie is to be the voice of the audience. Because we're thinking the same thing thinking, which is these people are totally obnoxious and terrible people.
But at a certain point, the movie totally forgets that he's even there, practically. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't really work. And also, as far as structurally speaking, I mean, the pacing's all over the place.
Yeah.
At the end, near the end, they sort of forgive him. In or on his side, but I don't know what he ever did to earn that. Like
the
main characters sort of have a change of heart
because the movie says so. Yeah,
exactly.
Towards the end, everything sort of wraps up for no reason.
Yeah,
it just kind of happens.
And literally, there's just more complication upon complication as far as the two characters. Relationship is concerned, and then it just they're just like, okay, we're good now, I guess.
I will also credit Christine Bransky being in the movie because she pretty much does no wrong, but she doesn't get a lot to do.
No,
she should have been more utilized as well. But you know,
I actually
her
think
line
maybe she would have been
great.
Better as the wife.
Yeah, you know, Judy Davis was a big thing in the early 90s, and she was in a lot of like really. Clever, weird movies at that time. She was to the early 90s what Helena Bonham Carter is now.
Okay.
She was in Naked Lunch and she was in Barton Fink and a lot of these kind of oddball movies. I think her and Kevin Spacey are doing what they do, but I don't think they just have anything to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I know that Kevin Spacey is a pretty problematic actor for a lot of people right now.
Right, and I wondered that watching it. I wondered, like, am I not connecting with it the way I want to because I have that hanging over my head
right now?
No,
I don't think so. I'm not advocating for what Kevin Spacey did at all or even saying he's deserving of having a career anymore.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm still going to watch Baby Driver. You know what I mean? Like, I am a believer of separating the art from the artist. I say what you will about him as a person. I do think he's a talented actor, but I don't think he is bringing a good performance to this movie.
Yeah. There was also a lot of weird parallels between this and American Beauty. Like, some of those arguments I felt like were almost like lifted from The Ref and then just retooled. And then his wife's name is Caroline. It's very weird.
I haven't seen American Beauty enough to.
Oh, I can never watch it again. That movie is like dead in the water now.
Yeah.
A movie about Kevin Spacey lusting after a 17-year-old? Dunzo.
Yeah. I can see that. Any argument against Kevin Spacey, I totally get, totally understand.
And that used to be one of my favorite movies, too. I'm really upset about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, this movie, The Ref, overrated.
I agree. I also think, I agree.
That's it. That's the show. That's the Netflix homework. What do you have for us next week?
So I was telling you this before the show. My wife, Ashley, has put an embargo on all non-Christmas movies on me. Mm-hmm. There's obvious exceptions like Star Wars coming out that we're going to see tomorrow.
Anything you see in theater, yeah.
Yeah. And it's very difficult to find a movie you haven't seen on Netflix and mm-hmm. B, a specific Christmas movie you haven't seen. So we went with the new Netflix original El Camino Christmas.
I don't know why you're doing this.
Oh, I know why. Dude, it was either this or Christmas Prince.
I'm telling you, there's good Christmas movies on Netflix. And as far as my list of shame goes, it's pretty expansive when it comes to Christmas movies, because that's not a genre that I normally go right to.
Well, maybe you should figure out some of those for next week, because this week we are watching El Camino Christmas.
Starring Tim Allen.
Tim Allen and Dax Shepard.
All right.
Hey, it might surprise you.
Maybe, yeah. Open-minded.
Yeah.
So, if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about today, how would you rank Guillermo del Toro films?
Maybe throw us some Christmas movie suggestions. Yeah, some Christmas suggestions. There's a bunch on Netflix. It's hard to determine which ones are good and which ones are garbage.
Yeah, what are your favorites? What do you think of The Ref? Are we totally off base here? You can do so. Send your thoughts to our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. We're also going to be discussing all things Star Wars next week, so I'm sure you could send us your thoughts on that if you happen to catch it over the weekend. if you happen to see this little movie, it might not be playing in your town. I'm not sure.
I think it's mandatory that it's playing like for everywhere. The next 2 months, yeah. Or something.
They're building theaters in like third world villages so they can watch it.
There's literally a promotion that I heard about where you can get like this cool collectible poster. Mm-hmm. If you see it every Sunday till like the middle of January or some shit.
For a poster, sure.
Yeah, you have to see it. It's like 4 weeks in a row.
Hey, if you have MoviePass, you can do that.
Yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, so other places you can contact us at at Jabber Podcast is our Twitter. And you can find the show on Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Player.fm, Google Play, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can find the show's archives and the RSS feed at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. And you can follow me individually on Twitter at BC Cassidy. Where do they find you?
They can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter and Instagram. Also, you should follow us because I think I'm going to try to live tweet El Camino Christmas. Yes. We had a pretty fun discussion about what movies we have left to see this year. Mm-hmm. So give us a follow and we can have good times on social media. It doesn't have to all be politics and people shitting on the dreams of everybody.
Yeah, so we have other friends who do podcasts you should be listening to, including Rod and Denise at The Listening Party. They have their last show coming up.
Ever?
Of their traditional listener submission format before they change format at the beginning of next year. And you should be listening to Denise's The Mascot Diaries. You should also be listening to Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Bill and Brian at the Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Falick, who may or may not be on the next episode. We're still undecided on that. Let's Start a Cult.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Until then, we'll see you at the movies, and give it to Gosling.